if the river keep rising, water gonna overflow.
Okay, let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting on NABA Zoom, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
My name is Tinsley, an alcoholic, and this reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual and our personal stories describes in our own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope that no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on this meeting's website, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. You know, these are amazing times we live in right now, and even though they kind of suck at the moment, we're going to look back and realize that we made some great new friends. Our speaker tonight is somebody that I consider to be a close friend, even though we've never met. I work up there in the area that he's from, in the Northeast. I'll be up there this fall, and I look forward to shaking his hand. We're not supposed to shake hands anymore. I'm going to shake his hand anyway. Maybe even go to a meeting with him, and that is an amazing thing that people can hook up over the Internet. And a true reminder that we are everywhere. And now I've got a whole bunch of new friends that I've met through him up there that come to the meetings on Zoom, and I look forward to maybe meeting them too. But I feel like I know him already. I'm really looking forward to hearing what our speaker has to say tonight. With that, I give you John R.
Thank you, Tinsley. My name's John, and I'm an alcoholic.
And hey,
I'm customarily nervous tonight for several reasons. One, it's not that comfortable speaking in front of the screen. Two, the fact that Tim asked me to speak for 40 minutes, and my sponsor is on the call here, and he says anything over 15 minutes is ego, so you will get some ego from me. And three, I'm just touched by the number of people that Kevin probably invited them that are here to listen to me. They've all heard my story before. Maybe not the long version, which you'll probably get. What it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. A little bit of my background. I'm the oldest of 6, 8, or 11 kids, however you count them. 6 for my mom and dad. 8 when you add in a couple of a brother and a sister from a stepdad, and 11 when you bring in his 3 kids into the fold. No matter how you cut it, I'm the oldest, and today I'm responsible for them all because both of our parents passed away in the last couple of years. My mom and dad are second-generation immigrants, from dad from Ireland and mom from Italy, and Catholic, and they both went to Catholic school. I grew up in a good household. I grew up, and I knew right from wrong. I grew up with birthday parties and playing sports, and a family dinner every night, big family dinner on Sundays, playing board games and everything else. My dad was an alcoholic. He grew up in an alcoholic home. And he was an alcoholic. He never got to Alcoholics Anonymous, not voluntarily, and not any that he stuck. And he drank himself to death at age 43 in Atlanta, Georgia. He's buried down there. And I'll probably see Tinsley down there when I come to visit with my sister, hopefully when the world opens back up, and that'll be before fall. We're planning a trip because we want to come to a NABA meeting. Live NABA meeting. My dad taught me how to play baseball. He taught me how to do mathematics. he taught me a lot of good things. He also taught me how to tell stories. He taught me how to drink in a bar. He taught me how to act. He taught me how to shake a hand. He taught me how to go to work and work hard. And my dad was a good man with a bad disease. And he, at the end, I saw alcoholism in its final stages with him. My mother was a saint. She had all us kids, and she said her whole life, her whole role in life was to raise children, and that's what she did. And she was the glue that held our family together. My mother was no stranger to alcohol either. She was not an alcoholic. My internet connection is unstable, Kevin. She did enjoy a couple of drinks every day for at least the last decade of her life. And my mom taught me a lot of things. She taught me how to write letters and how to get my homework done. She taught me manners. She taught me how to treat ladies. I grew up with four sisters and a mother, and, you know, when I open the car door for a woman, they go, "Wow." And I go, "Wow, that's required in my family." Anyway, we grew up around drinking. Drinking was around birthday parties. It was around, births and deaths and, weekends and around the swimming pool and around sporting events. And, it was natural. My parents hosted a lot of parties at the house. So drinking was no stranger to me, and I picked up my first drink at 13. I had already opened plenty of beers for my dad over the years and taken the proverbial foam off the top, sometimes a gulp. Really didn't do much for me until I was sneaking away to have my first drink with a couple of neighborhood friends, not too far from here, about 20 miles from here in Tewksbury, Mass. And it's funny, I've come all the way around the block. Some of you know my story. I have 16 states of geographic changes in my life. Some of it corporate moves, some of it just running against the wind. But I've been all around the country, and I ended up back home. And home is not only where the heart is, home is where a really big family is there too. I picked up that first drink. I had, you know, two beers that night. I'm not sure if I finished the second one. I did get drunk. 16-ounce Colt 45 malt liquor. I couldn't wait to do it again. And I did it again, and I did it again, and I did it again. Pretty soon, we were planning our weekends around it. By age 14, I'd moved to Nebraska. And the easiest way into moving into a new place was to find the people that I had a common denominator with. And partying was an easy common denominator, so wasn't playing sports. And playing sports and partying was, you know, that was the full house there. And that's what I did. And I played sports all through high school. I did well in high school. God gifted me with mathematics, so I could always be the number one student in every math class I was ever in, high school, college included. And that was me feeding my ego. I didn't learn that until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to be number one in at least mathematics. By age 17, when I graduated from high school, I had a few scholarships to some engineering schools, and I didn't take them. I was way too wild by then. Not only with alcohol, I had introduced some dry goods, any of and all of them by that point in my life. They were just a supplement to my drinking. I had my first DUI by age 18 when I had decided not to go to college. And it wasn't to be my last one. That first one I got off, that was in 1980. I got off for $88 and a careless driving. Can't do that today. Not in the shape I was in. But I'll tell you what, on that first DUI, and it's been a theme throughout my life, I was polite. I was polite to the officer. when he pulled me over, I was on a curb outside of the Coors plant in Golden, Colorado, and I said, hold on, can I finish my drink first? And he chuckled a little, and, you know, down at the police station, they had a blast with me. I blew something around a .23 that night. I didn't know what that meant at the time. It meant I shouldn't be driving, especially on a curb in 2 o'clock in the morning with a mason jar full of something, liquor and some sort of mix. But I got off that. I got off. One of the ways I got, they wanted to send me to alcohol classes at age 18. And I said, whoa, I'm moving out of state. And I did. I moved out of state. They said, well, okay, if you're moving out of state, pay your fine and don't come back for a while. And I didn't. You know, I moved out of that state to the next state, and wasn't too long before I did that same thing again. It was probably a year or two, and I had my second one. I was out working construction in Wyoming. And you talk about putting a kid in a candy shop. I worked on a mountain up in Wyoming building power plants. There were 3,000 men in a man camp. We got free food and a ride to work, and all we had to do was show up. And I was making $75,000 as an 18-year-old party animal, and I spent it all. Not only did I spend it all that first year, someone had started this thing where they said you didn't have to pay federal taxes for some reason, and that caught up to me real fast. It also turned out to be a theme in my life, maybe some tax issues throughout the last 40 years, but I got out of Wyoming. The way I got out of Wyoming was I found a girl who partied like me, and we partied together for about 6 months, and I proposed to her, and we got married, and we were both 20 years old, and we were kids, and we started to have kids, and we knew nothing about having kids other than we had family members who encouraged us and babysat for us, and we moved to Nebraska, and somewhere in there, my mother convinced my wife that I shouldn't be working construction, that I should go back to college. So I went to college with two kids. We had two boys. They're Irish twins. They're 50 weeks apart. And by the time I got out of school, they were 3 and 2 years old, 1986. And I didn't even know what had hit me. I didn't even know what had happened in 4 years. I got out of school in and out in 3 years because, you know, diapers were just, they were killing us. We were getting scholarship money just to buy diapers and food, living in a trailer house. But we always managed to save $10 for Saturday night to go bowling. And they had free babysitting at the bowling alley. And I would get hammered while bowling. And how she started to put up with me then and then continued for another 20 years after that, I'll never know. That's in the book in one of the stories. How my wife had faith and courage all those years, I do not know. For we alcoholics seem to have a gift for picking out the world's finest women. And we sure inflict upon them some tortures. And I certainly did that. I did that for a long time. I did not know I was doing that. My model for growing up was get up, go to work, bring home the paycheck, pay the bills, and then, you know, go play softball or hockey or basketball or football or golf or whatever. And that's what I did for a lot of years. I thought as long as I paid the bills and my wife was home with the kids, and she was for many years, that we were happy, that we were happy. And there were probably some periods of depression on the part of my wife being trapped at home with kids that were, you know, just like me. My mother used to joke all the time, you're going to have kids just like yourself. And I did. I did. My kids were hellions like most kids are, especially through the teenage years. I'll get to that in a second. But I got out of school and I went into the business world, and I was quite successful. I had a math degree. I became an actuary in the insurance industry, and I, again, ego, competition, and ego, those feed each other for someone who plays sports. And I did quite well in that, in the business world. I climbed the corporate ladder. I was very successful. I still had that gypsy in me that I would move. I would 3 years in a place, and I would either switch companies or take a promotion within the same company. And I did that. And only after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous did I realize that in 3 years I could pretty much burn down all relationships with my drinking. And I was just seeking a geographic change. And I would move into a new town, and I would, you know, clean up my act for a little while until, again, I worked my way into the partying mode that I lived a good deal of my life in. I drank and drugged for almost 39 years. And how did I make it last that long? Because sometimes I put a brake pedal on, sometimes I changed, and as the book talks about, sometimes I put ice in my light beer, so I drink just a little bit less. I never really drank any less. I just, you know, I consumed a lot of ice in the process is what I did. So a few corporate moves, a whole bunch of money. I chased money. I chased it, and I caught it, and it almost killed me. I had no problem being an earner, and the more I earned, the more I thought that gave me a right to do what I wanted to do, and I did that. By sometime around the early 90s, I picked up booze in another form, and that sped up the process of getting me to a treatment center. I went in 2001. I went to my first treatment center, and I got it. I understood it. I was there for 30 days, and then I did 30 days of aftercare. And, you know, corporate America put me in the finest places, and we played frisbee golf, and we had great fellowship, and I had a blast. When somebody today tells me they're going to treatment, I say, I envy you. You know, where else can you go? Hide from the earth, still get a paycheck, and hang out with people all day long in meetings. And I did that, and I got an A in treatment, too. You know, I did what they asked me to. I got through my five steps at Hazelden, and then went down, and I could recite how it works, and I could rattle off page numbers. And by the time I got back after 60 days and got into AA, I knew that you people wanted to hear what I had to say. And I got a sponsor. God bless Don Bartolone, a little short Italian guy from the south side of Chicago. He was the first one to say to me that no one's ever been too dumb for this program, John. We bury you smart guys all the time. And at the time, I didn't really get it. I thought he was just being, you know, sarcastic or whatever. But today, I get it. Today, it's all the smart guys that ask me to sponsor them. And that's God giving me. That's the same thing my mother said. You're going to get kids just like you, Johnny. And that's God giving me sponsees just like me. And I go, oh, no, not another smart guy with a big ego. So I got it. I understood it. I got out. I went to meetings. I made coffee. I talked my way out of the halls eventually. I got what I think was an honest year that first year. I had a reservation. I had that reservation fully booked probably at about 9 months. Can't wait till I get that medallion. And when that 1 year came, I used that reservation and I went back out. And I went back out hard for a few days, and I came back in with my head hanging, and my pride and my ego were hurt. And, you know, I couldn't look up from the floor, and it was hard for me to come back. And so today I empathize with people who come back into the halls, because I lived that. And I didn't just live that once. I came back in and went back out, and I came back in and went back. And eventually I went to another treatment center and did the same thing. And I did that for 3 years from 2001 through 4. And on the last one, they let me stay for 6 months in treatment. I stayed 120 at one place and 60 more at another. The defiance of the alcoholic. I got kicked out of both of those. I got kicked out on day 118 on the first one and day 58 on the second. So, you know, but the corporation still spent a couple hundred grand to try to make me well. And when I got out, I was driving my pickup home and I said, I've had enough. I'm not going back to that job or that family. It's their fault. And I didn't. I ran away from home in late 2003, early 2004. I stopped in Nebraska, where I went to high school and college, and I went to a sober friend's house. And I said, this is the answer. And it was for a little while. I got another honest year in 2004. And I didn't have a reservation booked. I had something better in mind, to find my high school girlfriend to buy two Harleys and to ride off into the sunset. And that didn't last too long. I picked up my first drink when the Red Sox won the World Series in 2004, and it was a really big drink because it lasted for 10 years. It took me until June 30th, 2014 to get back in here. And in that 10 years, it's a blur, but I still hear some of what I did when I'm sitting in a meeting and I'm listening to other speakers. I go, oh, yeah, that happened to me, too. And in that 10 years, I pretty much burned down my entire life. I gave away everything except for my life. I got four more arrests for drunk driving, bringing my total to seven. I gave away everything. I gave away, I had a credit card that's got no limit, right from the Nickelback song, and I used it. I used it up to an inordinate amount. And when I was all done, I was all done. And that was in June of 2014. I'd come home in 2009. I'd run away from yet another place out in southwest Minnesota. You know, there were ghosts chasing me out there or something. And I drove my bike home and I pulled into the driveway. I weighed about 40 pounds less than I weigh now. And my mother looked at me and she knew I was coming. She was happy I was there, but I could see the horror in her face. Like, oh my God, the prodigal son has returned, but what happened to him? Because I hadn't been home in a long time. But that was the last house on the block, and she took me in with open arms. And I stayed there for almost 5 years. And my last two DUIs were while I was staying there. The last one, I called her and said, I'm in jail. She said, good, stay there, and hung up the phone. She had had enough. It wasn't until my mother passed away 3 years ago that I figured out that God put me there. God put me there to spend the last 5 years of my mother's life with her. And that was a gift. You know, the whole time I was there, I was poor me another drink, poor me, I don't have anything, self-pity, self-centered, selfishness, that was, we think, was the root of John's problems. It was. But I came to look back on that occasion as one that was a gift, not a curse. And in June of 2014, I'd reached the jumping off point, and I had just enough memory of AA to get on my knees sometime in mid of June of 2014 and say, God, help me. That was the only prayer I had in me at that time. God, help me. Now, I had a couple years of sobriety, and I had in and outs of AA, court-ordered, wife-ordered, employer-ordered, everybody else-ordered. I'd been in and out of, and I loved AA when I was in it. I loved the people. But I had all but, my disease had all but let me forget about AA, and I said, God, help me, and God, help me. Within a couple weeks, I got a phone call from a guy up here in Haverhill who said, he had a job for me, and I hadn't worked on the books in 5 years, and this guy had a job, and all I had to do was get up early in the morning and show up for work and pack a lunch because we didn't stop, and the third thing was, your sister thinks maybe you'd like to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that my mother had asked my sister, She does not admit it. My sister is a model of anonymity. She does not admit that my mother said, please help your brother, he's killing himself. And so I came up here to the Haverhill area where I didn't know anyone. It was a new playground with no playmates and no playthings. And that was good for me. And I encourage that to newcomers today to come to somewhere that, you know, or to go off to somewhere. I threatened some of the people I sponsor with Casper, Wyoming, where I have a friend, you know, on a dude ranch out there. And I say, just do a year out there. You'll be okay. I haven't successfully sent anyone out there yet, but I'm waiting for the right person. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I... this guy who I was then working for and living with, who gave me clothes to wear and food to eat and money in my pocket, took me to my first few meetings, and he gave me a meeting list book, and he said, get some numbers. And I was thinking, why do I need numbers? I got a job now, and you're driving me? And he said, because I'm not going to drive you to meetings. You're going to need some phone numbers to call people for rides. And I did that. I got phone numbers. I started getting phone numbers, and I was still stubborn. God made it 110 degrees in July of 2014, and I thought I was going to walk to meetings. That lasted about three times, and then I eventually did something I hadn't done my entire life. I picked up the telephone, and I called a man and asked him to give me a ride. I called somebody and asked them for help, and that's where my journey began, was by calling somebody and asking them for help. And I called a guy who was probably 20 years sober, and he drove from, I didn't know where he lived, but he drove clear out of his way to pick me up and to drive me to a meeting, and then he drove me home. And on the way home, he said, well, you know, you might think about calling some people closer to you, but when he dropped me off, he thanked me for calling him. He said he wasn't going to go to a meeting that night. It was a really good meeting for him. And God bless that man. I know him today. He's in my circle of friends. Speaking of friends, my buddy Kevin, who read How It Works tonight, is a good friend. We had dinner together tonight. We talk almost every day, and he makes me laugh. That's a gift. My sponsor's wife, Katie, read The Traditions, and John's been my sponsor since July 2nd of 2014. I was 30 days. I had a temporary sponsor for 30 days, and I asked him at 30 days if he would sponsor me, and he said yes, and he set up a time to call, and I still call at that time. In the real world, I call at that time. He gets to sleep a little later today. Sponsor stands for sober person offering newcomers suggestions on recovery. My sponsor really hasn't offered a lot of suggestions. What he has done is got me to talk, and now and then when I ask him something, he shares experience, not suggestions. There's no musts. He says things like, John, you can do anything you want to do as long as you're willing to pay the price. And, check your motives. You know, I'll ask him if maybe I should do this or do that, and check your motives. And he just revealed to me last month that if I'm checking my motives, I'm probably asking a question that the answer is no to. That took 5.5 years for him to reveal that to me. So I've earned almost that first marble they gave me. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he suggested I get a greeter's job at a place that has six meetings a week, and I got a greeter's job. And then he did suggest that maybe I smile when people came in the door. I wasn't smiling a lot in that first month, so I did that. And a funny thing happened to me. My friend Brian H., bald and smiling Brian, after a couple of weeks, came in and said, John, it's nice to see you here. And what happened when Brian said that to me, Brian the biker, who I thought I'd sized him up for about 3 weeks with a big smile, and he's also the first man who hugged me at that meeting. What happened was I immediately felt part of. I felt part of at the Whittier, and that was a big deal for me. And I know that's a big deal for newcomers, so I try to do the same thing for newcomers today. I try to stick my hand out and welcome them. And when I see them a second time, I remember their name. Because not only did God bless me with a good memory, but I have a couple little mnemonic tricks that I can remember people's names with, and I do remember their names, and they're impressed by that. And I think it helps them feel part of. I know it helps me. Frequent contact with newcomers and each other is the bright spot of our lives, one of my favorite lines from the book. And on the page before that in the book, it says, it works. It really works. I love the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I chaired a noontime Big Book human meeting today. And no coincidences. What Tinsley read on page 29, from my point of view, I found God in the first treatment center I went to. Somebody told me to throw my cigarettes under the bed while I was down there in the morning to ask for help, and then to look for the little coincidences that happened after I asked for help. So I found God in 2001 in a treatment center. He hasn't left me yet. He was waiting there for me. Or he'd been with me the whole time, and he came out when I finally asked him to. But what happened this time was I started to do the drill. My sponsor and I both read the same two readings in the morning, although I've added a few readings to that. But, you know, the daily reflections and the little black book, the 24 hours, not AA approved literature. So what? It works. It's the one we both remember the easiest. And we occasionally talk about that. Hey, good reading this morning. And sometimes we go even a little deeper on it. But really the strength of my program, besides getting a job and keeping a job in Alcoholics Anonymous since I've been here, and I have a home group, one God, one group, one sponsor. But what really helps me is that asking for rides for 39 months in a row. I plan my day around a meeting and planned my day around calling someone and asking them for a ride. And by the time 3.5 years was up, I had about 3,500 phone numbers in AA. And I sometimes share, my friend Sean Patrick, who's in a hospital on the tail end of COVID with a heart attack, God bless him, I hope he's on here right now. He laughs when I say, I had a fleet of vehicles, it was 250 strong. They all had the same last name on my phone. It was AA. And if I wanted to take a pickup truck to Chelmsford on a Saturday night with air conditioning that I could smoke in, I knew who to call. And a lot of people laugh at that. But it's the truth. It is the truth. Alcoholics Anonymous has done so much for me. Step one, on December 31st, 2014, I was at an Alcathon. It was my third Alcathon of the trifecta in 2014, and I was at a dance down in Salem at St. Julie's. And I had heard so many speakers that night, and they kept saying, second to none, a life second to none, a life second to none. So many times I heard it. I was sick of that phrase by then, and today I use the phrase, I have a life second to none. I came out of the dance for a smoke break, and it was a beautiful night. It might have been a full moon. I looked up in the sky. I put my hands up, and I said, okay, God, I surrender. And that was the first time I said, I surrender to the disease of alcoholism. I am powerless. I am totally powerless. And that was my first admission of it. And I felt a great weight leave me that night. And I, people who know me in this area, they know I go to a meeting just about every day. And I get to meetings 30 minutes early. That was a suggestion by my sponsor. That was a necessity to be a coffee maker or a greeter or a secretary or you set up chairs or whatever. and I still get to meetings 30 minutes early today. I found that when I was getting to meetings 30 minutes early, the people I met, the kind of people I met, were like Tim and Tinsley and Chucky and Timmy K and my sponsor and Julie. Even today when I get on a Zoom meeting early, the winners are there early. They're there fellowshipping. They're there scanning the screen or scanning the room. They're looking for the newcomer. They're looking to get the newcomer involved. And that's what I've done since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. I asked my sponsor at the end of year two, I said, these guys want me to get in an AWOL. And he said, I don't think you're ready yet. You can do it if you want. You can do anything you want as long as you're willing to pay the price, but I don't think you're ready yet. And I'm so grateful for that advice. I got in one at the end of year three. I did another one at the end of year four. I did, you know, they were men's groups where we worked on the steps, where we went through step five, where I continued into steps six and seven and eight and nine. I am still in the process of making amends. I'm Irish, I'm Catholic at any given time. I don't have many resentments. I was a good man my entire life. I really wasn't that good at being bad. But there are still some amends I have on my list to make. They're not stuff that keep me up at night. And when presented with the opportunity to make them, I make them. I first talked to my sponsor, and sometimes I ask God as well, is this the right time? And I've actually made three in the last month, which were, they're getting easier to make. And I'm getting better at making them. And they're about mending fences that I broke down. And they work for me too. Alcoholics Anonymous has been a great gift to me. A really good gift. And I say when I introduce myself, I'm sober today by the grace of God, the fellowship and steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those are all free gifts in my life, free and unmerited gifts. And I am so grateful. Grateful for the opportunity to speak tonight. And that's all I got. Thank you.
Good job.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
I think I was muted the whole time.
Fabulous. Thank you.
Good job. That was great.
Thank you, John. Hey, I think that was 40 minutes of non-ego. I think you may have set a record. You suppressed your ego and shared from the heart in your experience. We got a chance to experience your strength, and we now have a little more hope. Thank you, John.
If the river keep a rising, water gonna overflow. If that river keep a rising, flood water gonna overflow. Just like that old river, baby, it's my time to go. Thank God I'm home.